composing the here and now, recollecting mindfulness here and now, just to this perception to train ourselves to use this as a way of centering, of grounding, of being, rather than living in the world of self-views and worldly attitudes, believing time is reality. So these words, sati sampajanya, sati panya, this is a ways of training ourselves here and now. Here and now, what's happening? It's like this. Sound of silence. Physical posture, breathing. Just noticing, observing. An attitude is like in the different upayas and skillful means the Buddha encouraged us to use, the ways of looking, of investing, of being here and now, but with certain attitude. So like investigating, being the observer, then there's using the Bariyatti Dhamma as a way of looking at the here and now and the present, like the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, there is dukkha. So that's the scriptural teaching, the first sermon, and then that encourages us to patibhata, to look, to observe the suffering or feelings that you're experiencing, maybe physical discomfort, different kind of mental states, moods, doubts, worries. So just this emphasis on dukkha is gives us a perspective of looking at this not as a projection of the mind, but observing, being the observer of dukkha rather than the owner. And on into the causes of suffering, the cessation and the path. And like metta bhavana, loving kindness. It's a bit confusing because it all sounds so kind of may I abide in well-being. It sounds, you know, the structure itself is about, you know, me wanting to abide in well-being, you know. It's like a prayer. Freedom from affliction, freedom from hostility, freedom from ill will, and so forth. Or is that a way of an attitude? Is metta, loving-kindness, an attitude to be mindful with, rather than a position, you know, is it sakyaditti, may I abide in well-being, or what is it pointing at? Me, Ajahn Sumedho, I want to be happy, don't rock the boat, may I be, that could be sakyaditti, or it could be, you know, it's an attitude of metta, of accepting whatever I'm experiencing this time through the body, through the mind, emotions, an attitude of non-aversion, of acceptance of maybe dukkha or unpleasantness or anguish or despair or self-hatred or whatever. May I abide in well-being isn't about my personality, but it's a reflection on not creating problems around the realities of the conditioned world in the present moment. It's like this. So as metta practice, you know, it always begins with may I abide in well-being, then it goes on to may everyone abide in well-being. And sometimes that's easier to do, isn't it? I find it much easier for me to wish everyone, you know, all creatures, the very best, but the sense of may I abide in well-being. And then using and learning to use the attitude. What is metta practice really? Is it kind of just being sweet and loving and non-critical and nice to everything? Does it mean you have to approve of everything and just be terribly kind of goody-good about life in general? You can know, life is all about love and kindness and happiness, and we can go on into positive thinking. Or is it more profound than that? Is it cosmetic, or is it an attitude of non-criticism, of accepting even evil and ugliness and misery and doubt and despair, not approving, but in our own minds if such emotions, such conditions arise, then the attitude of metta then is letting them be what they are, rather than judging, rather than trying to destroy the evil, the bad, or just trying to cover up everything with positive thoughts. You know, like evil, there's this pretty powerful word in English. It's, you know, we're culturally conditioned to think we've got to fight against evil, conquer evil, the axis of evil, the enemy, the devil, satanic forces. And this is a cultural, you know, our dualistic culture is to fight off, resist, destroy the evil forces. And then with metta practice, you know, it's not fighting, but knowing, you know, knowing good and evil as conditions arising, ceasing. So accepting of evil, when I say accepting, then people can get very upset because it sounds like we just go along, evil rises, we just commit evil acts accordingly. Or accepting doesn't mean approving or acting on it, but allowing if evil thoughts or emotions to be the knower of them, meaning you don't just react with aversion, hatred, and try to destroy them, but know evil from this non-critical metta attitude. It's like this. So one can have metta for the devil. Doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean a kind of sentimental, I wish you all the best, devil kind of thing. That's being ridiculous. But it is, if such devilish images or thoughts arise, our relationship to it is non-criticism, non-aversion, non-hostility. But knowing, discerning it, it is like this. So in the, you know, in the scriptures, the Mara tries, after the Buddha's enlightened, Mara comes and puts the Buddha to the test, you know, tries to tempt him or delude the Buddha, and the Buddha says, I know you, Mara. That's a very, I found that very helpful, because it's knowing, knowing Mara, not, there you are, Mara, and shoot him, push him off the cliff. No kind of violent reaction or cursing, you know, no anger, but just knowing. It's discerning. It's not personal views about Mara, but it's the discerning from the Buddha Panya level. I know you, Mara. It's like it's recognizing. It's discerning knowing. Where a personal knowing, you know, say, I have, Mara comes in and tries to seduce me, delude me, and I say, get out of here, Mara, I hate you, and I try to kill him. And so, and then Mara's successful, isn't it? He's convinced me, he's deluded me, seduced me. Now applying that to, you know, from the first practice of metta, may I abide in well-being, and this is a formula, you know, of metta, but it's not just a kind of, you know, it's not superficial at all, even though at first it can sound, you know, just being very positive and nice about life, but it's a metta, when you really contemplate loving kindness or metta, it's profound. It's not just superficial sweetness, but it's a profound willingness to discern and not take sides, not be caught in one's personal habits of attraction and aversion. So in, you know, like in my own practice, for example, just with sound of silence, you know, the conditions, training myself over the years of monastic life to deal with anger, disillusionment, jealousy, fear, despair, confusion, resentment. And knowing, you know, clearly the personality, the personal habits that arise, and the conditioning of the mind, my cultural background and you know, karmic tendencies are like this. Then in recognizing the sound of silence, you know, just using that as a reference point, not to get rid of negativity or, you know, it's not to annihilate anything, but a reference point in which I can patiently accept pain and anguish and despair, because I'm not adding to it with, you know, liking, disliking, approving, disapproving, feeling guilty, being self-critical. Or being deluded into, you know, into attitudes of righteousness and that quite easily arise in any religious aspiration within an individual. So this you can see it as metta. Sound of silence doesn't particularly, you know, it's not even a sound, kind of vibration, or it's recognizable. And then the tendency to proliferate about myself and what I like and don't like it stops the proliferating tendency of the way I'm conditioned to struggle, trying to get rid of, trying to hold on to, feeling guilty, self-critical, blaming others, the whole panorama of Ajahn Sumedho is then accepted non-critically and ceases. It's not created into anything more. It's not compounded. And so in Thai, in the Thai language, they use the, you know, like compounding or sankhara. They use the Thai words pungdang, which means to add to something, season something. So something arises and you add something to it. So like, say, anger, you feel the condition, somebody says something abusive to me, you know, so then you feel this resentment or anger arising. And then to compound that arising is, how dare you, you shouldn't, and on like this. That's bad, it's wrong. Or it can be, I could be, think I'm being very high-minded and think I shouldn't feel anger towards that person. I try to make it into something about, maybe I'm feeling guilty or blaming the person or blaming myself. That's what we call compounding, isn't it? Adding to the actual condition arising. So like even the thinking mind will call it, anger. But that's another additive, isn't it? Compounding, putting a word to the actual arising is another kind of compounding, where the sound of silence, the thinking mind stops, and then the feeling, the conditions for that emotion arise, but it's not making a problem about it. It's allowing it to be, but not attaching to it through getting, you know, grasping it and getting caught in your own personal tendencies, how you deal with anger, or trying to suppress it and resist it and deny it. So this is a subtle, this is subtlety, isn't it? Because, you know, it's ideally, you know, we shouldn't get angry, we should have metta for each other, and so forth. It's all the shoulds of life, the ideals. But we live in the, not in the ideals, but in the way things are. And this is where this itta-bhajya-da, this conditioning, when the conditions arise, when you know, this is the karma of being human, human individual, or being a mammal, you know, dogs and cats get angry. You know, anger is a kind of primal emotion. Lust, anger, fear. These are, you know, these are primal conditions. These are part of the package of being born as a human being, or as a an ape, or a dog, or a cat. So this is, and then the human problem is that we identify with it. You know, we have ideas of, you know, if we're really mindful samanas, then we shouldn't be angry. We should be full of loving kindness, even when somebody, you know, attacks us or humiliates us or abuses us in brutal and unkind ways. We should, you know, we should just feel loving kindness for them. But can you do that on a personal level? Can your personality, the sakyaditi, is that loving kindness? You know, can you make yourself love and like something that's totally unlikable as a person, through sakyaditi? I can't do that. But I can, through understanding, discerning sakyaditi, then I can deal with the condition, the karmic conditions that I have to experience in this form, whether they're praise and blames, happiness, suffering, whatever. Because then one is no longer coming from this compounding, from ideals are compounds, aren't they? How things should be. They're creations, and we add them to life. But Dhamma, you know, this word Dhamma is not it's not about ideals. There's no kind of ideal Dhamma. It's here and now attention. It's reality. It's the way it is. It's the discerning, knowing that is available to us in this human form with whatever kind of karmic inheritance we have as individuals. So, having metta for example, somebody insults me and I feel this anger rising. Metta for the anger is not pungdang, it's not compounding or adding or making it anything more than what it is. It's totally accepting the feeling. And then that I can do in this reference to sound of silence, because it's here and now, and it stops the tendency and the habit of making it more than what it is. And then the perspective on it's allowing the anger to be and arise and cease. Because if you don't attach or resist, its nature is to cease. what arises ceases and is anatta, non-self. So when we, you know, when we chant the sharing of blessings and things like this, sharing the blessings of our life with Mara and things like with the, you know, the devils and the devas and so forth, it's you know, this isn't about personal. It's not trying to be something we can't be as a person. You know, to be terribly, you know, to try to make ourselves or convince ourselves that we should be an ideal person. But, and they have this kind of generosity, this willingness to learn from evil, from Mara, from insults and despair, from not getting what we want, from wanting things we don't have, and all the whole range of human immersion, habit, tendencies, wholesome, unwholesome, willingness to learn and to discern, to see the anatta of it all and the anicca, the dukkha. So Mara, or, you know, Satan in the Christian terms, is really, you know, they will have relentlessly pursue you through your life because it's your best friend. It won't let you get away with anything till you finally totally let go. You know, it keeps putting you to the test. So in the scriptures, Mara was still after the Buddha, after he was many years enlightened, you know. And this is, you know, this realm we live in, it's like this. It's not an ideal realm. It's good, bad, beautiful, ugly. The whole range of qualities and quantities, conditions. Then we have these human karmas to live with, the sexual desires, sexual bodies. And notice how in modern life, you know, the Western world, we identify strongly with sexuality. You know, it's me and mine. It's judged as good, bad, right or wrong. Held up as sacred and the best thing that happens to human beings, or it's considered dirty and impure or vile or whatever. Then there's different tendencies, sexual tendencies, karmic tendencies, homosexuality and so forth. All these that we identify with these tendencies, maybe karmic tendencies. And it becomes an obsession of the society, you know, the sexual identities are, you hear it all the time, everything is, you know, about sex these days. And it's, you know, so it's this sense of this is me. And then we judge it according to what society regards it as being, right and wrong, good and bad. Allowable, unallowable. Those are the compounds we add in this is right, this is wrong. So whatever you know, well, sexuality is the nature of the body. It's a sexual form, and it's the body is for procreating the species. The male body, female body are like this. You know, so it's just the, you know, we as a community are celibate community, not as some kind of puritanical position, an attack against, you know, some kind of puritanical view of sexuality, but being able to observe it, to be the knower of sexual desire, of lust, of one's personal views or tendencies or preferences, you know, like this, then the metta is non-judgmental. It's not trying to justify or reject or approve or disapprove, but knowing. So that celibacy or brahmacharya is, it has to be voluntary, you know, you can't force, when you're forced into some kind of celibate life, you know, it has, you know, it's not, it's just a form of tyranny. But becoming a samana is where you know what you're doing. You're choosing celibacy. A brahmacharya, because it's a way of, say, looking and observing these sexual energies that one experiences through the body and through the changing conditions that we experience in life is like this. And the knower, the discerning of sexuality, isn't sexuality. It's non-personal. It's not me anymore, or the sexual arousal of the present is seen in terms of Dhamma, of what it really is, rather than judged according to social attitudes or personal attitudes about it or identities. Because the conditions, you know, itta bhajyanta, this one of, you know, the insights into conditionality, when the conditions arise, and this is, you know, when for anger, for lust, for fear, for jealousy, envy, confusion, despair, resentment, boredom, aversion, and so forth, then this is the, you know, these are ways of describing certain energetic experiences. But our relationship to them as mendicants, as samanas, as celibate, is our soul, you know, the way of practice of developing the path is being aware of them. What arises ceases. And to allow something that has arisen to cease is metta, isn't it? It's not trying to get rid of it, but to be patient, allowing, say, evil that has arisen, to let it cease in its own, you know, but not act on it or speak on it, but know it, discern it. So one have metta for Mara, it means that, you know, when Mara comes to delude you, say, I know you, Mara, and then Mara ceases. It's performing its duty as a condition that arises and ceases. The Mara is not the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. So you can call this transcendence, you know, this relationship of the unborn to the born. But, you know, whatever words we use, that's not quite it. You know, there's just the limitation of language. Because transcendence, sounds, can sound very dualistic, you know, like above it all, you know. We're up here and the kind of conditions are over there, down there below us. But in the reality of the here and now, then they're together, the unborn and the born. The born can't, conditions can't be born if there is no unconditioned unborn. They're not independent agents. But because of human ignorance and our identity out of ignorance to attach and identify with the born, the created, the form, then we are, you know, we're kind of caught in this samsaric motion of birth and death. And so then this reflection of being able to perceive, to see, from this unborn, uncreated awareness, the born and the created. No, training them, like this sound of silence practice, I found it effective. Because it, you know, training oneself to refer to it wherever you are. When you're washing the dishes or walking from here to there, or in the London Underground, or Heathrow Airport, meditation hall, whether you're feeling healthy or sickly or whatever, things are going your way or things are going all wrong, everybody loves me or hates me, then the sound of silence, training oneself, remembering this scintillating, resonating vibration. And then remembering it, and as you cultivate, it means you keep kind of extending it, so you're staying with it for a longer period of time, because it is like a stream. It doesn't just begin and end. Maybe your attention, you know, you have it and then you lose it. But it's always here and now. And it's not kind of obliterating anything. It's not like it just takes over and obliterates all other conditions. It's like space or background or consciousness. It has a, like the unborn, uncreated, it can function like this, because as you acknowledge it and kind of cultivate it, rest in it, you know, it becomes, you know, you begin to notice it everywhere, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whatever state you happen to be in. So it can be seen as metta practice also. Because when I'm resting in this silence and this stillness, then I can accept whatever. You know, not resisting, judging, struggling, analyzing, criticizing, caught in maybe personal emotional habits or reactions to conditions that are happening. It can stop just getting, you know, getting caught up in the habitual patterns. So then then it allows me to give me space or ability to accept something I don't like and don't want. Where I can have that discerning ability to see that I don't like this, I don't want this, is like this. It's a emotion that arises, is like this. And in the sound of silence, it doesn't, it's not an annihilation of it, but it's not a perpetuation of that desire. I'm not feeding it, nor resisting it, suppressing it, or attaching to it. So then, you have to discern this for yourself. Is that liberation or not? You know, is that suffering or not? Is it, you know, letting things go, being what they are, is that dukkha or non-dukkha? And so, like, investigating, is that self or non-self? Is this awareness in the silence? That's, you know, then my intuitive sense is that's non-self. It has no personality. It's not a condition that I create out of ignorance and desire. But it gives me the perspective on those tendencies, on those habits that I've developed in my life as a human being to create myself and believe in my own thoughts and emotions and feelings and so forth, that I, you know, if I didn't have this perspective, I would be just, you know, fumbling around with in the same old way with all the conditioning I've acquired. So then, loving kindness, that's putting a more kind of positive, you're saying loving kindness is a more inspiring way of looking at something, but it can be, it's not sentimental or superficial, it's profound, it's unconditioned, non-violent awareness of the nature of conditioned phenomena. And the patience, being patient with the very things that on a personal level we're very impatient about. And then on a personal level we suffer a lot from impatience. I don't like this, I don't want that, I don't approve of this, how can we get rid of this, and so forth. Anger is always a sign, a lack of patience. So in this, with this stillness, this sound of silence, this patience, with this flowing, resonating, allows us to not make problems or compound the condition that has arisen. So then, then I can affirm non-suffering is like this. This is not suffering. So I'm using the words dukkha and non-dukkha, attachment, non-attachment, self, not self. Or just take the Pali words like lopa, dosa, moha, greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, greed and non-greed. Can you discern when there's no greed and when there is in your consciousness? We tend to, not notice, not recognize, not discern non-greed or non-hatred or non-delusion. But, you know, because we're so identified with greed, hatred, and illusion, with views about it. Greed is, you know, we shouldn't be greedy. Hatred, we shouldn't hate. Delude, I don't want to be deluded. You know, so those have pejorative meanings, greed, hatred, and delusion. And the causes of suffering. But ignorance is the cause, isn't it? Ignorance of greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's not getting rid of greed, hatred, and delusion as some kind of annihilation, but knowing, discerning when non-greed is like this. Then the sound of silence. That may be greedy feelings, then you're aware of them and their presence and then their absence, because they arise and cease. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Alopa, adosa, amoha. These are words to remind yourself what is there, greed or non-greed. Now, in this resonating silence, there's a discerning of non-greed right now that I'm experiencing. So it's a discerning non-greed is like this. Non-aversion is like this. Now, delusion isn't so clear, is it? You know, greed, lust, and that is quite strong, and hatred, anger, resentment. Delusion, moha, is, you know, doubt, worry. You can start doubting, am I just fooling myself? Is there a moha? Or maybe there's a slight bit of moha still there. Okay, you know, so we start getting caught in trying to figure out whether there's a moha or delusion. But in this perspective, emphasis on the unborn, uncreated, sound of silence, then the doubting tendency, am I deluding myself, is seen as a condition arising and ceasing. Doubt in vicikicca. And your own, you know, tendency to be self-critical and fears and guilt and all these forms of delusion can be, there's a discerning, they're present, and then through letting their presence, acknowledging their presence, then you're aware of their absence also, because then they cease. And amoha. And then this is peacefulness too, because it takes one's, you know, one is peaceful rather than, you know, because the saṃsāra is not peaceful. Lopa, dosa, moha are not peaceful states. You know, you can't make the saṃsāra a peaceful place. But you can abide in peacefulness through awareness and discernment. So this discerning, like non-greed, alopa. And that's where, you know, this kind of trusting yourself. You're the one that knows what's happening inside you. You know, on a personal level, that's why, you know, you can be caught with kind of doubt and worry and feelings of, you know, self-doubt or confusion around it. But, you know, this, and as long as you keep operating from the self-view, from sakkiditti, then of course you're just perpetuating the self-view. So it's not getting rid of self-view, but discerning it. And so this is my suggestion. But you have to find out the result of it. But it from your own practice. But it's a matter of learning to trust this. Not yourself, not your personality or your views or opinions, but to this awareness. And then it puts me in a state of alert attention, listening, and then one can be the observer of the arising and ceasing of lopa dosa moha. And so, it's like, I know you, lopa, isn't aversion to lopa, is it? It's knowing. I know you, dosa. I know you, moha. It's just, letting it, knowing, discerning, and letting it be what it is. And of course, the lopa dosa moha are arise and cease according to conditions. So because we have these sexual forms to live with, the human form, then the conditions for lust arise, conditions. And of course, celibate life, we're trying to live in a way that isn't particularly promoting a lot of sexual temptations. Shaven head, the robe, and so forth, is a kind of, way of not perpetuating or exaggerating or personifying the sexual tendencies one has. But still, within the celibate life, we have to, we're aware of that, because that's part of the karma, that's the of this species. And so our relationship to it is knowing, discerning, non-acting on it. Not because of the vow of celibacy, commitment to celibacy, non-action. So one of the epithets for the Buddha is knower of the worlds, knower of the world, loka vidu. And so this is, don't think that loka vidu is a quality of the Buddha of India 2,500 years ago, and that he did it, but you can't. It's not that we become Buddhas, but it's like when we're in this, when we discern this unborn, and our relationship to the born then is a knower. Knower of the world, the born is the world, isn't it? The born, the created, the form, the condition. This is the world. This is me. This is you. This is England. This is on like that. You create the world. Knower of the world. Loka vidu. Don't sell yourself short by thinking that you're just a ordinary person and nothing like the Buddha. The Buddha was an enlightened prophet, and you're just a neurotic, screwed up personality. Don't believe it. This is within the whole purpose of this convention of Buddhism. Is to, like, taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha isn't about me as a person. It's a reminder Lokavidu, Buddha, being the knowing, trusting in this awareness and discerning and cultivating it. Bhavana, Patibhata, meditation.
Ati